Okay, so as we begin our final presentation, the final class, we are going to discuss the boundaries of tax avoidance and subterfuge, and we are going to hear from Mr. Ted Gelt and from Rabbi Halpern on this subject. And thank you once again, Mr. Gelt, for presenting today, and Rabbi Halpern as well.
It's a pleasure. It's a pleasure to present in this context and to have as a partner Rabbi Shmuel Halpern, who is a tremendous Talmud Chacham and wise, way wise beyond his years. And it was really a wonderful insight to work with him on this project, and a tremendous honor to speak in the forum of the Kollel. I'm used to speaking at law school at the University of Denver tax program, where I've taught for 44 years. And so this is a nice new type of forum for me. So I'm looking forward to it. What we're going to talk about today is a concept in tax planning about how far one might go in structuring the affairs of their clients in order to avoid tax. We're not talking about evasion here, but we're still talking just about avoidance. And even by going to avoidance, we have some limits that we have to be careful about. So we call this substance over form, economic substance, subterfuge. In the Talmud, it's referred to as a canunia, and it's a type of thing where someone structures affairs so that it may not have the reality or the substance or the economics that really is required in order to have that result. So we have some examples that we'll go through in a few minutes, but let me first set the stage for you. And I'm in the materials under the subterfuge, and then the slide that's marked background. This all started in the 1916 with the 16th Amendment, which was made it constitutional to have an income tax. And so carrying that forward in the 1930s, there were some statutory provisions that were enacted in separate acts, not in the Internal Revenue Code as we have nowadays, but in separate tax acts. And they allowed taxpayers some flexibility in structuring their affairs. And the seminal case here is Gregory versus Helvering, which was a case of involving Mrs. Gregory. Helvering at that time was the Commissioner of Internal Revenue Service. In the old days, instead of serving the office, Commissioner of Internal Revenue Service, you actually had to name the person who was serving that function. So there are thousands and thousands of cases against Mr. Helvering because of that position that he held for so long. In this particular case, Mrs. Gregory, if you look at the diagram here, hopefully I can walk you through it and make an otherwise difficult area of tax law as simple as possible for use in our ethical discussion. And that is that Mrs. Gregory owned a corporation. That's the square on the left that says trader business, was involved in a regular trader business that she had. And in addition, that corporation had gone out on the market and purchased some public stock. And the public stock had gone up tremendously in value, and she wanted to dispose of the stock and then take the money out and be able to use the money for individual purposes. So the way that the tax law was structured then, similar to the way it's structured now, if the Trader Business Corporation were to sell the corporate stock, then there would be a gain recognized by the corporation on that sale. And then if the money was then distributed out to Mrs. G at the bottom box in the middle, then that would be a dividend. So there would be, if we go to the box on the far right, a double tax. There'd be a tax at the corporate level. There'd be a tax at the individual level. And the tax at the individual level would be ordinary income. Today's rates, that would be 40% instead of a 20% capital gain rate. Plus, there'd be a tax at the corporate level. Today, it'd be 21% at the corporate level. So we'd have two levels of tax, and it would be ordinary income. Not a very happy result for Mrs. Gregory. A lot of her profit would be eaten up in tax. So if we go to the next slide, she went to her tax advisors And her tax advisor said, we think we can solve your problem by structuring this in a slightly different way. And that is, we'll take the Trader Business Corporation and we'll have it contribute the public stock to New Corporation, which is that box in the middle. And then we'll distribute the stock of New Corporation, which is the arrow down on the left, spin off to Mrs. G. We'll spin that off under a tax provision which allows no gain or loss to be recognized by either the business corporation or by Mrs. G, so she can receive that stock without any level of taxation, provided that she takes the same basis, the same cost in that stock of New Corporation that she had in the Trader Business Corporation, which let's say is zero. So she has no basis in that stock. And then what she does is she causes New Corporation to be liquidated. That's down at the bottom. We liquidate NC, and she receives the public stock. At that point, she pays capital gain, so a 20% tax, only one level of tax, and she gets the benefit of getting to increase her basis, step up her basis, up to the fair market value on the date of the liquidation. So we've eliminated the corporate level of tax completely. We have given the tax to Mrs. Gregory of capital gain, 20% instead of 40%. And so she goes off very, very happily on her way. If you look at the right of this diagram, you'll see something called transitory corporation. New Corporation has only existed for a day. So it's transitory. It's only had that existence just for one purpose and one purpose only: to reduce the amount of taxes to Mrs. Gregory. That's it. So the Internal Revenue Service challenged this and said this transaction does not have substance. And that's later, through other cases called Coltec and things like that, morphed into a concept called economic substance, which has actually been codified in a way in Section 7701O of the Internal Revenue Code. And so it's been codified to this economic substance. Here, the economics of Mrs. Gregory were exactly the same had she had the corporation sell the stock and then distribute a dividend, as they are if we do the spinoff, liquidation, and then sale of the stock. So by using a different technique, the economics haven't changed, the substance hasn't changed, but the tax result has changed. And so the Supreme Court of the United States held that there is no substance to this transaction, and therefore Mrs. Gregory had to use the direct route and pay the double tax. Yes, ma'am.
They don't realize a tax gain because they receive and sell it immediately. And that seems to me to be very similar to this situation. So the person who had achieved capital gains on their stock isn't paying tax on the capital gains, and the not-for-profit is getting the benefit of the increased capital gains without paying tax on it.
100% correct. But that's because there's a statutory provision under Section 170 that allows a gift of capital gain properties such as stock and a deduction at its fair market value without causing the recognition of gain. And the nonprofit, the charity, the 501c3, doesn't have to pay tax on gains recognized when it sells property.
Why is Mrs. G different?
Mrs. G is a taxable individual. She's not a not-for-profit corporation.
It's an exception for not-for-profit.
Yes.
Due to public policy.
Yeah, it's
public,
right, because of public policy. It's called called Section 501. Okay. Okay. So over the years, and I developed this teaching at the tax program, but I developed a kind of a metaphor for, especially for non-tax lawyers, to be able to understand this concept of substance over form maybe a little bit more clearly, and to so we can see with it and see and play around with it just a little bit. This is pretty quick, but you all had in your law school classes, I think, torts. And in torts, you had the doctrine of respondeat superior, right? So I won't define it, but basically it's where the employer is liable for the actions of the employee. When the employee is within the scope of the employment, so the employer is liable. But if the employee varies out of the scope of the employment, then the employer is not liable. So if you take a look at the next slide, you'll see that it's Frolic versus Detour. If we have an employer that has manufacturing widgets and it wants to deliver those widgets, so it has an employee that delivers the widgets to the customer at the bottom of the page. That's the direct route. You might remember, you're probably not old enough to remember, but there was a project on I-25 called T-Rex, where they were redoing I-25 around the DU area. And what happened was that they had to close the highway to do some of the construction, so you had to detour around through Pearl Street, and there's some shops and restaurants and things along there, and you had to drive around there and then get back on the highway if you wanted to go south or north. So you had a detour. So that is what I have on the right side of the slide, where it says roadblock. That's the detour side. When there's a legitimate reason for having to veer off the direct route, so that is a detour. That would be if there's a legitimate business reason for structuring a transaction a particular way, then that transaction should be upheld. On the other side, where you see road bar, and what I mean by road bar on the Frolic side is I mean your friendly bar along the way. And the employee stops at the bar along the way and detours or frolics around and then gets in an accident over there. The employer is not liable because the employee has left the scope of his employment. And that's what structuring a transaction like Mrs. Gregory's tax advisors advised was, to set up this transitory corporation, to set up a situation that had no economic reality, no economic substance, no economic consequence to it. And that's what the Supreme Court said. That's too far. That's too far. Now, before we get into our scenarios, which is part two of these slides, skip a couple pages to Roman numeral 3. So here are the ethical considerations for the lawyer. And the Colorado Code of Professional Conduct and the Model Rules of Professional Conduct primarily center in your area, right? They center in litigation. They're really primarily focused on litigation. There's not much really for the transactional lawyer. There are things there, but I mean, it's not nearly to the extent that there are ethical rules that relate to the litigation practice. So here there are a few rules, though, that really do affect our situation. Rule 1.2d, a lawyer shall not counsel a client to engage or assist a client in conduct the lawyer knows to be criminal or fraudulent. Now, tax evasion is criminal. Tax avoidance is not criminal. Tax avoidance is something that a lawyer can do to set up a client in the proper way. The Supreme Court in Gregory versus Halvering said a taxpayer can arrange their affairs in an appropriate manner to try and reduce taxes. That's a perfectly legitimate thing to do. But there has to be some economic reality to it, some economic consequence, some economic substance. It can't just be a transitory corporation, as was the case in Mrs. Gregory's situation. So a lawyer shall not counsel a client to engage or assist a client in the conduct the lawyer knows to be criminal or fraudulent. That may not be our situation. And in comment 12 to that rule, both in the model rules and also in the Colorado rules, it says paragraph D applies whether or not the defrauded party is a party to the transaction. Hence, a lawyer must not participate in a transaction to effectuate criminal or fraudulent avoidance. of tax liability. So I don't know whether it was just because it was written by non-tax lawyers that they slipped in the word avoidance there, or whether there's some import to that word, but that causes me pause to say we better not be advising our clients to go too far in this avoidance area, because it may be violative of this Rule 1.2D. Just a caution. Yes?
Is that a noted distinction between the definitions of avoidance versus evasion?
Yes. For the criminal law purposes, it's evasion that is criminal, that is a crime, but avoidance is not. Now, there is a penalty under this Section 7701O that I mentioned before, where they codified the economic substance rule, that there are penalties that would be imposed not only on the client, but also on the tax professional that might be imposed. Plus, there's something else that overlays this whole rule of tax practice called Circular 230, which was actually a rule that was developed right after the Civil War, about people who were representing people to make claims against the government for loss of property during the Civil War, like loss of horses or confiscation of wagons or things like that. And so after the war, they came up with this claims process where people would claim back. And in order to practice in that, one had to meet a certain minimum level of competency. And that's a Circular 230. And now they've carried it forward now to 2019, 2020, and it relates to the practice of law before the Internal Revenue Service, or the practice of tax. I shouldn't say just tax law, but tax accounting also, before the Internal Revenue Service.
Is anything else where the IRS has jurisdiction, whether it's Bank Secrecy Act or anything else?
Probably. You know, I haven't looked at it in that regard. Probably it. Okay, so it does go that far. Yeah. Good, good. Okay, so that's Rule 2. That's Rule, that is Rule 1.2D. Rule 2.1, a lawyer may refer not only to law, but to other considerations such as moral, economic, social, and political factors that may be relevant to the client's situation. Here there's a common five. In general, a lawyer is not expected to give advice until he's asked by the client. It was touched on a little bit earlier in the presentation. But look at what it's further. However, when a lawyer knows that a client proposes a course of action that is likely to result in substantial adverse legal consequences to the client, the lawyer should offer advice if the client's course of action is related to the representation. So if we're representing a client and the client lets a lawyer know, you know, I'm going to go through this particular transaction and set it up. We'll see about five of these coming up. Even though I'm not asking you, I don't want to know what the advice is. Does the lawyer have the obligation? It appears to me that the lawyer has the obligation to say to the client, this is not going to be a good way for you to design this transaction. And then finally, Rule 3.1, a lawyer shall not assert or controvert an issue unless there is basis in law or fact for doing so, which is not frivolous. And that touches on this aspect of setting up a transaction that has a non-economic consequence to it, where it's just set up for the purpose of avoiding tax. So with that, I think I'll turn it over to Rabbi Halpern, and then we can go back, and hopefully we'll have time to go through one or more of these five scenarios that we set up.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Gelt. It's very humbling to present together with Mr. Gelt, otherwise known as Reb Tzvi. He has the background and credentials, I should say, to present the legal side of this as well as the Talmudic side. Quite a lot better than I think he's been studying Talmud from before I was born. So with that being said,
nothing,
right. Yes, nothing at all. Just his Talmudic proficiency.
I think it was a compliment, actually. I'm not sure.
Okay, so we have several sources here, and it's sort of divided into three sections. We'll just run through, hopefully we'll get through all of them. First, we have a few sources that deal with anti-avoidance legislation. Then we will deal with what I think is the crux of the issue, or the substance over form. Is something substantive or not? And finally, we'll drop with the ethical side of it and some areas where we find throughout the Talmud where avoidance seemed to have been almost recommended. So we'll deal with that as well. So to start with, source number one deals with what is known as the obligation of Maaser, or tithing, where one would have to tithe the grain that they grow and produce that they have in their field. The final act of the preparing the grain, which would make it liable and obligated in tithes, is smoothing over it in the silo. So you have a pile of grain, now you've smoothed over the top at this point, now it is liable. So the Talmud discusses a scenario where one would gift or sell his grain to a non-Jew, and the non-Jew is not liable for this miser in the land of Israel. A non-Jewish landowner does not have to give this tithe. So let's just say this fellow's name is Reuven. He owns this big field, or many fields. He has all this grain. He wants to gift it to his friend, the non-Jew, or sell it to him, and that way he will be exempt from the tithing. So the smoothing of the grain piled in the silo, source one, done by a non-Jew, does not exempt one from miser, which is tithing, obligations. This is a rabbinical enactment established out of concern that landowners might routinely sell their grain to non-Jews for the final stages of production. So here we find anti-avoidance enactment. We're afraid people are going to go ahead and do this. So the Talmudic law says it doesn't work. Even though technically when it belongs to a non-Jew, it should be exempt. It's not, it's an exception to the normal rules of how it should work for the very purpose of preventing and this avoidance activity. On the other hand, if you turn the page in the Gemara over there, in Menachos, concerning the chal obligations, this is just the last part of source one. However, we need not create a similar enactment with regard to chala, which is the obligation to take a little bit of dough off. The sages did not establish a similar enactment, and if one would gift it to a non-Jew, they would be exempt. And the reason for this is because one could easily avoid the obligation by needing a smaller measure of dough at one time. So when there's a very simple mechanism to avoid the obligation, to avoid the chala, we need not establish an elaborate, mechanism to make sure that people are not engaging in avoidance. So that we see in terms of the legislation. In source two, we have a Gemara in Bechoros with regard to the firstborn animal, which has certain sanctity and therefore certain restrictions of use. The halacha is that once it receives a blemish, a significant blemish, it loses that level of sanctity, and it is now permitted. Those things that were restricted are now permitted. So we're concerned that someone will go ahead and intentionally inflict that wound. So now this animal is useful. It can be used. So source two, one who inflicts a wound upon the ear of the firstborn animal is forbidden from slaughtering and eating the animal. According to Rabbi Eliezer, permanently forbidden, and in the opinion of the Chachamim, the majority of the sages, until it receives another blemish on its own. So here again, we have technically the animal now has a blemish and it loses its sanctity, and the sages say, well, you have to act as if it still has continued to have that sanctity, and therefore it is forbidden. The Chachamim, the majority opinion says if it receives a blemish on its own that is not based on your act, from there on it's permissible. An interesting side note here at the end of source two is if one who inflicted the wound died, can his heir slaughter and eat the animal? So does the penalty transfer over to the heir? Does it go, is it based in the Talmudic terms, is it based on the property? That we say this property is now forbidden going forward, or is it based on the owner? Or is it the monetary owner that the penalty is placed upon?
So that, is there an answer to that question? This is a gavra chefta issue. It is a gavra.
That's very, that's well put. It is a gavra chefta issue.
No, but so is the answer, is there an answer?
I believe the Gemara means with a question, but I did forget that.
It says that if it's, that he can, he can eat the animal. The
heir
can eat the animal.
There you
so
go. See, I was right.
Like it's a gavra instead of a... Right.
Okay, the age thing before, I was just trying to excuse myself. When it's Tzvi proved to be a more proficient Talmudist, I can say, haven't been at it as long. Okay, thank you, Tzvi. So that's it. That's source two. In source three, we find a different form of anti-avoidance legislation, and that is, this source actually, Reb Tzvi brought it to the table. Mr. Gelb brought this one to the table. Source three, one who consecrated all of his property and wishes to divorce his wife. So Rebbe Eliezer says that he must swear that he will not remarry her. Rabbi Yeshua says there's no need to swear. So this, the point of this is that this fellow consecrated all of his property to Hekdesh, to belongs now to the temple, and now he wants to get it back. So he has this kenunya, like Rabbi Tzvi put down before. We have this kenunya, this avoidance mechanism, this scheme. Whereas he's going to divorce his wife, and his obligation, his kesuba obligation to his wife, is prior to the consecration of the property, and therefore it has precedence. So his wife can now go to the temple treasury and collect her kesuba, and they happily remarry the next day, and now all that property is back in the house, and it's wonderful all over again. So the Rebbe Eliezer says to get around to prevent this, the husband, divorcing husband, must swear he will not remarry his wife. So here we have a different form of anti-avoidance legislation, which is we're going to find a way to make sure it doesn't happen. As opposed to the previous cases, we said even if you went ahead with the scheme, it doesn't work. Here we say we're going to make sure it doesn't happen because we're going to force him to swear that he doesn't actually remarry her in the case that he divorces her. So that we have, those are the section that deals with the legislation. So going forward in source 4, which brings us back to the concept of tithes, we find a scenario where it is completely legal, you know, sort of like an avoidance type issue. It's completely legal and it's okay. There's no enactment against it, no penalty, but it is not considered praiseworthy. So we find in source 4, Rabba Bar Bachana said in the name of Rabbi Yochanan, who said in the name of Rabbi Yehuda Bar Ilai, come and see how the later generations are unlike the earlier generations. While the earlier generations would bring their grain home through the front entrance of their home, because in addition to the smoothing over of the grain in the silo, there is an obligation of a small amount of grain that if it goes through the front of the house, it's brought home in a normal fashion, it becomes obligated, whereas if it comes in some unusual way, it is exempt. So the earlier generations would bring it home through the front entrance, thereby obligating the grain and tithes. The later generations would bring it in through the roof to exempt it from tithes, and that's completely acceptable. In the legal sense, there's no penalty for that. However, it's very clear in the Gemara there in Brachos, it's not considered very praiseworthy that this fellow here is trying to avoid the tithes. So that sort of wraps up the legislation side of this. Source 5, I think through 10, is going to deal with, at least I understood it, I'm not a tax lawyer or any sort of lawyer for that matter, so the way I understood the crux of the issue, you'll comment if you think I got it right or wrong, but there's the one source that I call it a Talmudic source that directly deals with an issue of avoidance is a response of the Rav Asher, which we're going to see in source 7. But before we get there, we're going to just build a stage for that by quoting some of the sources that he quotes. So that starts in source 5 with a Mishnah in Tractate Nedarim 48a. So source 5, we'll just read it and we'll explain if there's a little bit needs to be explained. So there was a fellow in Beis Charon, it's a place, whose father took a vow not to benefit from his son. The son was marrying off a child and wanted his father to attend the wedding. He therefore gifted the wedding hall and food to his friend and said, "This I grant to you, only so that my father can eat alongside us." The friend said, "If it is mine, I hereby consecrate it all." The giver said, "I only gave it to you so that my father could join us. So I never gave you, I never gifted it to you so that you should have such jurisdiction so you can consecrate all of it." The sages rule that any gift that the recipient lacks the ability to consecrate is not a valid gift. So bottom line is, if you're gifting something to someone or selling something to someone, then they truly have to have the ability to do whatever they want with it. And if they cannot consecrate it, so then the gift was never valid. In our scenario, if the gift was never valid, so the property still belongs to the father of, let's say, the groom or whatever it was, and the grandfather, his father, who has a vow not to benefit from him, cannot come to the wedding.
It goes along with wanting your cake and eat it too, right? We have it happen in our practice, unfortunately, a lot. People want to come in and they want to give things away to their kids so they can avoid state taxes, but they really don't want to give it away. That's what's happening here. He's giving it away so he can avoid the vow and his father can come and join the wedding, but he's not giving it away so that it's completely given away.
Very good. Okay, so that was the discussion. You see in source 5 two extremes. You have a gift that is, it's completely not valid. I think in the tax, discussion, it's called a sham. Is that correct? It's not, there's no validity at all. And that we see that the sages ruled is not considered any gift at all. It's completely null and void. Source 6, which is somewhat surprising, is the concept of a gift which is contingent on a return. So Rava said, one who gives an esrog to his friend, so it's the holiday of Sukkot, and someone gifts an esrog to his friend and says, this esrog is gifted to you on condition that you return it. The recipient can fulfill his obligation so long as he returns the esrog. So the first day of Sukkot, you need to own the esrog that you use. Needs to belong to you. And we have this, you know, this was common practice back in the day. You had a community of hundreds of people and you can afford one esrog for the community. So it belongs to, to Mr. Wealthy Man, owns this one esrog in the entire town and everyone uses it. So how do they fulfill their obligation on the first day? So there's a mechanism called a gift on condition of return. And the Talmud says that it has absolute validity as a gift. It's a gift. It's not a sham in any sort of way. It is complete and valid gift. So these two sources, 5 and 6, prepare the way for source 7, which is the response of the Rivash. Rivash, I think, was 13th, 14th century, the late, what we call Rishonim. So the Rivash writes, regarding the particular question, I'll just give the question really, really quick before we get to the source. The question was, there was a local tax, maybe it was a sales tax, I don't know, it was a local tax with an exemption for residents. It was a tax that was applicable to people who didn't live in town, but not applicable to people who lived there. And there was a fellow who lived out of town who owned merchandise, and the middleman or the person who was going to peddle it or whatever it was exactly was a local person, and he was therefore tax exempt. So what they wanted to create an arrangement where Mr. Middleman would at least temporarily own the merchandise, thereby avoid the tax. So Rivash said the following. He said, if there's an outright gift to the middleman for the sole purpose of avoiding the tax, so there's no doubt this gift is a sham, as the intent is only in order to be able to swear that it belongs to you for tax purposes. Apparently you need to swear on that, and it is no validity as a gift. This is just like Matnas Beis Chorom, which is source 5, but the story with the wedding. The giver didn't intend for it to become yours, and you didn't intend to truly acquire it. What you can do, however, is have it gifted to you contingent upon your returning it. This form of giving is considered a valid gift, like we just saw about the esrog in source 6. So here we have a very interesting thing. I assume that if there's a historian here, they could maybe help us out. But I assume that in the time of the Rivash, there wasn't any elaborate anti-avoidance legislation, and the obligation to pay taxes is based on the law of the land. And apparently, this was okay in the law of the land to create this form of avoidance. And basically what the Rivash is saying, that a sham is not okay, but to do avoidance in such a way where there's no business purpose, there's no substance at all, it's a transitory corporation like you mentioned earlier, Tzvi, and it's totally, the Rivash says it's totally fine. That's allowed. Again?
So it's drawing a distinction between source 5 and source 6, and the Rivash is basically saying that as long as you structure it like a source 6, that works.
That's correct.
So we draw a line between source 5 and source 6.
That is correct. That is correct. I want to leave time to get back to the cases.
Okay.
So, no, I'm not trying to cut you off. I'm just going to run along here. Okay, so that, I think, gives the concept of these two transactions. Let's see three more sources on this point. Of substance versus sham and so on. So source 8 refers to the obligation to immerse utensils purchased from a non-Jew in a mikvah before Jewish use. So there's sometimes you don't have the ability to immerse it and so on and so forth. So what do you do? So one of the workarounds is to gift it to a non-Jew. And then you're just borrowing it from the non-Jew. When you borrow a utensil from a non-Jew, you do not have to immerse it. So source 8, gifting the utensil to a non-Jew is a sham when the utensil remains in the hands of the Jew. Again, there are many, many examples of this throughout the Talmud, and I'm pulling way off of transactions and so on, very much ritually based. But you see this concept. The Taz is saying people use this sometimes with Keurig machines where there's questions about how you can immerse the components that may need to be immersed, if that is your opinion, but without getting too technical
without causing the machine to
break.
Right.
There was a certain non-Jewish woman who worked in a Jewish organization that I'm aware of who owned many tens of Keurig machines. So the Taz said that this doesn't work, because this Keurig machine is sitting prominently on the counter in your kitchen in the Jewish home, and this is obviously a sham, right? It would be one thing if it was a temporary thing and you're using it for a day or a week, and then maybe you were borrowing it, but you're keeping it for the lifetime of its use. There's no way that this is legitimate, so therefore the Taz questions that validity. Again, we're not focusing on the practical halacha of immersing utensils. Yes?
Oh, so I know the situation where they have this, where they transferred it to the Gentile boy, and then he leased it back to the one who gave it to him.
Okay.
It's kind of a nominal amount of the lease, so he still owns it, but he leased it back, and apparently that was considered good.
Very interesting. Okay. You made it a little bit more legitimate. Okay. Maybe the Taz would agree that would be okay. What was that? There's some substance to that. That's correct. Okay, so in source 9, we find a common practice is selling chametz before Pesach to a non-Jew just to avoid the prohibition against chametz. So the Tu'a Shar writes that this will help avoid a rabbinic prohibition, but not a scriptural one. With chametz, it according to many opinions, it's only a rabbinic restriction because the chametz is null and void when we make a declaration right before Pesach that it should be null and void. Now the prohibition against keeping it is only rabbinic, and now according to the Tu'ah Shar, selling it to a non-Jew, even though how many non-Jews that buy the chametz are actually showing up to collect the chametz, even though there have been stories. But Reb Tzvi actually, we'll just jump for a second, source 10, he recommended we contrast this with the concept of Shemitah, which is in source 10. It says, this is a quote from the Chazon Ish, which is heavily, heavily disputed. I don't mean to get political if you are in on the Israeli scene, but selling the entire land of Israel to a non-Jew is worthless, unlike the sale of chametz. So there's a concept of the Shemitah year where we're obligated to let the lie land fallow. We can't work the land. According to many opinions, it is only rabbinic in our day. There are opinions that believe it's biblical. Rambam holds that way. In any case, many authorities allow for a wholesale sale of the land to a non-Jew, thereby exempting it from the Shemitah restrictions. And the Chazon Ish, again, there are many opinions about this. I'm just zeroing in on the opinion of the Chazon Ish, which is widely held by many, certainly not all, that selling the entire land to a non-Jew is worthless, whereas selling chametz to a non-Jew is okay. So this was Reb Tzvi's point. I give credit where credit is due. So you see a very interesting distinction here in terms of sham or substance, where, you know, we have a community, let's say, of hundreds of people. We're selling the chametz to Mr. So-and-so, to the mayor. Right? In Greenwood Village, we've sold the chametz to the mayor for several years. So he's buying all the chametz of the Jews of Greenwood Village. Okay, very nice. You know, for a dollar, right? So he's unlikely to actually show up and eat or take any of that chametz. But in theory, they actually... The rabbi in charge goes through many transactions to establish that it's an absolutely valid transaction. It's like five different things done to make sure that the transaction actually happens. You know, there's money and there's picking up the documents and there's this and that. But the bottom line is, it is possible. You know, it has happened. Technically, he can go and take the chametz. It's not a complete sham. Whereas the Chazon Ish argued, if I sell this entire country to a non-Jew, I was doing a little bit of research as this immigrant from Russia. You know, he was thinking about converting and he was friendly with the rabbi, so they sold him, you know, they gifted him the money, and then he uses that money to buy the entire land of Israel. So, you know, it seems, and the stipulation in the document says that he has the ability to go in there with a tractor into anyone's field and build himself a swimming pool. So, the Chazon Ish argued that's taking it too far. You know, so there's substance and there's a lack of substance and there's a lack of substance. Again, this is not unanimous, but this is an interesting illustration of where you might draw the line. Okay, should we jump back to the cases?
Especially if one of the Jews in the community has a $1,000 bottle of scotch, you know, over Pesach, the mayor might be tempted to come in.
He might. Yeah, he might.
Just point out on that, in the contract, it does stipulate that if he doesn't decide to take the homage, he will figure out its value afterwards and not the available value.
Okay, good. Good, I'm glad.
It's not hard to get a scotch back afterwards.
Yes, ma'am.
What about the issues of fairness and equity? So, for instance, the Jew, if he buys safe. It doesn't need to bear a hechsher. But if you buy it from a farmer in Israel, it does have to have a hechsher. So why is it that we allow the Jew to buy it from the farmer in the United States if tithings is so important? And we don't want anyone to work around the rules, but you're giving me the greatest workaround ever by giving an incentive to the Jew to buy not from another Jew.
That's a great question. So I don't know if this will be satisfactory, but I'll throw out what comes to mind is that where we have these enactments or whatever it is to prevent this avoidance, it's where you have an obligation, and then now the question is, I want to avoid the obligation. So the tithing obligation is Israel centric. It's based on, the obligation is on produce grown in the land of Israel. So now I have this produce, I'm a Jewish landowner, I have this produce in the land of Israel, I want to go ahead and sell it to a non-Jew to exempt myself. That's where we consider that a workaround. However, the obligation, the Torah obligation, never extended past the borders of the land of Israel. So, you know, whether you're Jewish or non-Jewish, if you have a farm here in Colorado, there's no obligation to give tithes. So if you're buying, you know, fruits and vegetables at King Supers or wherever you might buy them, that's not considered a workaround, because you're not dealing with something that begins with an obligation. I don't know if that's if that is a satisfactory answer to your question. Well, it's different than other areas of the Torah where as Jews we have an obligation to do A or B or C. This is something where as Jews we have an obligation to treat our land that has a very specific sanctity in the land of Israel in a certain way. So it's not a Jewish obligation towards your land in particular, but it's towards your land that has the sanctity of the land of Israel. So
if you look at the codifiers of the many mitzvahs of the Torah, often speak about this is bound to the land of Israel. This mitzvah applies everywhere and anywhere. So you'll see a clear distinction on there. There is a section of land bound mitzvahs that are specific to the sanctity of the land of Israel. So it's just if you follow through the Talmud, you'll see it's
your restrictive covenant.
What's that?
It's the form of restrictive covenant simply based in Israel.
There are certain laws that just apply to that.
Yeah. That's what
it's an interesting
like.
Study. You should take a look at it.
And it may not just be sanctity, right? It could also be that in that context where Jews are living together in a political entity, they want to, there's a lot about sharing the wealth in a way that you wouldn't necessarily want to impose when they're living under someone else's political control, and they have their own rules for how that stuff works.
Yeah.
And there's a bigger problem with selling the land of Israel than selling the land of Denver.
That's another issue. That's right. That's another issue. Okay, I think we'll jump back to the cases. We'll leave the other sources for the sake of time. We'll go back to the cases.
So this is on Roman numeral 2 under the scenarios slide, and it's divided into two slides, 1 and 2, and then 3, 4, and 5. So I try to set this up in a way that – we try to set this up in a way that it's kind of relevant to people who are involved with the Kollel from a financial contribution standpoint, and to look at things like that, to look at how we might help 501c3 organizations, charities, in certain ways. So there is in Colorado that you might be aware of something called the Colorado Child Care Contribution Credit. We refer to it as the 5C credit. And it's a very valuable resource because it allows a person to get a tax credit that is a dollar for dollar reduction of Colorado income taxes for an amount equal to 50% of the contribution that's given. So if a person, let's say, has a $2,000 tax liability to the state of Colorado and they give $4,000 to a qualifying child care charity, so then they can not only deduct their amount of contribution to the state of Colorado, but they also get a 50% credit, which means that they get a $2,000 credit or reduction to their state income tax. So in Colorado, Colorado, the tax is 4.63%. So we'll call it 5%. So if a person, let's say, has $100,000 of taxable income, so the tax at Colorado level would be $5,000. If a person gives away $5,000, he would get a $2,500 tax credit, and the amount of tax to Colorado would be $2,500. If a person gave away $10,000, they get a $5,000 credit and would pay no state income tax. If they gave more than $10,000 away, the credit would still be 50% of what they gave away, but they would have to carry it forward. They could only take it up to the amount of the tax they have that year, but then they could carry forward for 5 years and reduce the amount of taxes that they pay to Colorado going forward. Okay? That's the child care credit. The child care credit, however, has got to be paid in cash. Can't be paid in property. So if a person has a car, you've heard these commercials on the radio, right? Cars for kids and things like that, right? So a person has a car and they want to contribute the car won't qualify. It'll get them a charitable contribution deduction, but it won't qualify for the child care credit. So what do we do? What do we tell a person? Can he get it or not? So what's suggested here is, well, maybe what he should do is he should contribute the cash to the charity and then have the charity buy the car. What's the problem? The problem is that that cash is making a round trip. It's got no economic substance. The cash is going in and it's coming right back. And really what's being gifted is the car. Probably too far. But if he sells the car to a third party, like maybe there's now these car companies, right, that buy your car even if you don't buy one of theirs. And so maybe you sell them the car and you get the cash and then you give the cash. That would work because that's got economic consequence to it. But what doesn't have economic consequence is if I get the cash right back from the charity, there's no economic consequence. So that's scenario number one. Well, you know, how much does it take to make it wrong? Does it have to be 100% wrong to be wrong, or is it 90% wrong to be wrong? There's some economics, I guess. Okay, maybe so. Where do you draw the line? I'm not sure.
That's why we ask the tax lawyer.
Rabbi? Well, I go back to ethically, can I advise it? Can I even advise on this? Okay. How about the down payment? The down payment case. So in this case, an individual, there's a typo there, I see. He wants to purchase a home for $500,000. And he needs a down payment of $100,000 in order to be able to get a loan. The weight there should be want. I take full responsibility for all these typos. What does he do? Where does he get the $100,000? Normally, doesn't have it. So how can he have $100,000 and be able to show it so that he can get the loan for the amount of the house? It's not a tax question, but so one way is the employer. He's got an employer, and he's got a really good relationship with the employer, and the employer is willing to give him $100,000. The employer gives him $100,000, and then he uses that for the down payment of the house. There's a Supreme Court case actually arising in Colorado called Duperstein. Mr. Duperstein had a secretary, and he gave her a Cadillac. And she didn't include it in her income because she said this is a gift. And the Supreme Court said in an employee-employer relationship, there's no such thing as a gift. No such thing as a gift in that kind of relationship. So therefore, Mrs. I don't remember what her name was, but she had to include that in her income. So here would be a situation where the employer is going to give it to the individual, but it's really going to be treated as compensation. So very nice. He's got his $100,000 for his down payment, but he also has tax on $100,000 to pay. Not a happy result. In situation B, the employer bonuses the $100,000 to the individual. That has substance and that's great. The employer gets a deduction. The employee gets a $100,000 bonus, but he has to pay tax. In certain ways, the way that one might be able to do this, and I think would have substance, is to gross up the bonus. for the amount of the tax. Do you know what I mean? Compute what the amount would be with tax, so it would net $100,000. You have to have a really nice employer to do this. Now, what about C? C is what I think is maybe a canunia, maybe a little bit too far. Maybe this is a subterfuge. The employer loans money to the brother of the person, and then the brother makes the gift. If the employer loans it to the person who's buying the house, it won't qualify for the down payment for the loan because it's got to be money that's not encumbered. So here he loans it to the brother, and then the brother gives the money to the... So that's a question we could ponder.
That's a good question.
He's got to pay interest under tax law. You're 100% right. And depending on who the employer is, right, you might have to do what's called a heter iska for Jewish law purposes, which is another topic. Correct. Correct.
And whether or not the gift is coming out of that fund or otherwise, it's the brother gifting to
his brother
buying the down payment.
Right.
I would imagine that that's simply governed by statutory limits on gifts.
So it would be a gift. And the brother would have whatever gift tax consequences there are, which now, because the exemption is so high, it's very, very... at this level, wouldn't be a problem tax-wise. But how is the brother going to get the $100,000?
That's not part of the scenario here.
That's right. But he's going to have to pay it back.
He's obligated. Right. There's a write-off at the corporate.
Correct. Correct. And if there is, there would be income to the brother for canceling the debt.
Right. But if that happens because he was financially irresponsible as opposed to intending to perpetrate a fraud, that's a different situation, right?
Yes.
Correct.
Correct. Yeah.
Okay. Yes. Thank you.
Just relating this to the last CLE, do you do pro bono taxes for, like, I don't know, poverty lawyers?
I was sitting there, should I feel guilty or not about this? So I went up to the judge afterward and I said, you know what we do in our firm is we do tax returns. Our tax department does tax returns for serving soldiers and also for veterans that can't afford to pay, and we do it for that. I don't know if we have a poor lawyer category.
Come to more class.
I don't think. Are there poor lawyers?
Can you use your hours as an attorney, like your pro bono hours as advisor, as a sometimes. You gave.
Well, that one source said that one should try to give away 10% of their hours. We give full credit at our firm to associates that do pro bono. For the pro bono hours that they do, we count that like billable hours, so that they, for partnership track and things like that, it all counts in.
Thank you. Thank you, Rabbi Halpern. Thank you all for coming. I would just like to encourage everyone, those who have not been to the monthly Torah Protection classes, please feel free to reach out and to try those at the Kosher Deli. We do them September through June. And again, if you'd like to have a conversation for the Capital Campaign or to live on, please feel free to call a rabbi. Please feel free to take lunch with you, or snacks, or both. With you as you go, and I wish everyone a good Shabbos, a Shabbat Shalom, and we hope to see you again. Take care.
That's a hatzlacha on your work there.